So the fantastic bio, but what it says is Mike is the operations integration manager for the commercial crew program, responsible for leading and managing the real-time and near real-time mission support during all phases of flight of NASA commercial partners, SpaceX, Boeing, Sierra Nevada, Blue Origin, including serving as the chair of the NASA mission management team and integrating program level operations, requirements, and implementation strategies for accomplishing the objectives of safely flying astronauts on new spacecraft. On a personal note, Mike is married to just a fantastic person, Martha Hess. He has three kids. I know he's actively, he's way more actively involved than I am, a scuba diver, rock climber. I think he's been a longtime volunteer for the Boy Scouts. I've personally known Mike for, goodness, almost 18 years now, and he's just an absolute great guy. So he's going to, with that, I want to turn over to Mike, and he's going to have a great presentation for us. Thanks, Mike.
Hey, thanks, Jorge. I appreciate that introduction. Let me jump back to sharing my screen again. And I will go like this and share and jump that. And then I will, how does it look, Jorge? Are we full screen?
We are perfect. It looks great.
Outstanding. Okay. Thanks for the introduction. And let me jump into a little bit more about this commercial crew thing. Here you can, this slide kind of depicts it. You've got a SpaceX Dragon and a Boeing Starliner, both. They wouldn't be heading the space station at the same time, but the goal is for both of these spacecraft to be delivering crew to space station on a regular basis. So the NASA vision for commercial human space flight to low Earth orbit is to develop it into a robust, vibrant enterprise with a number of launch providers, starting with these two, that will help a wide range of government and public uses. You folks may have seen that SpaceX is starting to do private astronaut missions. The thought would be it would spur sort of a new economy. Space station could be the anchor tenant for these folks, but there could be commercial additional space stations, different places to go to take people. But we're trying to develop this capability for the United States. You know, how this fits into the bigger NASA scope of things. And you've got Earth, Moon, and Mars of everything that's going on. So you've got a notional future commercial platform that could be a new space station alongside ISS maybe someday. Commercial launch vehicles with those crew delivery capabilities. Of course, we've got Orion and SLS headed to the moon. There's commercial lunar landers. There's the Gateway space station that will, small space station that will orbit the moon and gain full lunar access when we go for surface operations for crews. We'll have robotic surface missions and, of course, Mars landings, and there's one set for next week. So this fits into the global NASA strategy. This is just an org chart. You guys don't care about that. I want to see if I can play a quick video for you. I don't know whether the sound is going to play. I have my doubts, but I'll see if I can make this happen. Yeah, sound's not going to play. Just imagine some cool music. So these are scenes just of the preparation that we've got. All these crews that go to space station, they are space station crew during the period of time they're on board. So they have to go through space station training, but then they also have to get trained in how to fly their specific launch vehicles. These launch vehicles are built and tested, rigorous testing with both Boeing and SpaceX and their launch facilities. There's a lot of training that goes on for crews, for ground teams. And then, of course, we go through launch operations and testing. All of these things have really been the focus of returning human space flight to Kennedy Space Center. And, of course, we did the Demo 1 test flight, which was an uncrewed mission. And we've had the Boeing OFT mission that was also uncrewed. That one didn't make it to space station, but it did make it to orbit, so we're able to test and retire a whole lot of risk on that system. And they're hoping to have another launch coming up here. I'll talk about that. So it's just been over the last 7 years or so, we've built up to this point where we are now flying crews, which is very exciting. Why do it this way? It's really different. You know, in the past, NASA has done essentially the design of spacecraft, and then we've handed it on to large aerospace contractors to develop. Well, this is a really different public-private approach. The goal, the NASA's purpose is to develop the safe transport for NASA and NASA-sponsored astronauts to and from the space station. But the public purpose is support the development of non-NASA markets for commercial human space transportation services. And the way this was developed, NASA put together some relatively higher level requirements, but it didn't go down to spec things out like how to design it. And the designs were left up to these providers to figure out. They just had to meet the requirements, and they could even show some sort of equivalency using other kinds of parts and equipment. You know, maybe they want to use a piece that is not used in aerospace, but they are able to show, hey, this mechanism or this thing has equivalency, and we may be able to use it in our spacecraft and for the same relative level of safety and protection of the crew. So we went through a march of all of these different funky contract names, CCDEV, CCDEV2, and they all had different milestones, and there were different companies that put in to start towards developing both launch systems and crew capsules. And then as it went along, it sort of winnowed down to where we are way over on the right. You can see in CCTCAP with Boeing and SpaceX getting $4.2 and $2.6 billion for a certain number of launches of crews to space station. But parts of these other contracts are still in work now. As you can see, the Sierra Nevada Dream Chaser is still in development. And if that gets to a certain level of milestone, perhaps they could get a contract also to deliver crews to space station, crews or cargo. Next slide here. So where we are currently, station has its current resupply services to ferry, supplies and equipment to and from space station with Northrop Grumman and SpaceX. And that's ongoing with space station. And what we've got in the commercial crew program, of course, is Boeing and SpaceX to take crews up and down. Now, you look at the picture below, some of these folks haven't flown yet. They're the first ones that were named to fly on Boeing Starliner. They're not yet ready to fly crews. But the folks more on the left side of the page, Bob and Doug, have already flew on Demo 2. And Hopper and Ike are up right now on Crew One, but we'll show more pictures. The two providers, a little bit about the rockets. Now this is, I grew up as a spacewalk and EVA guy, so I've had to learn a heck of a lot about launch vehicles and get smart on these sorts of things. Boeing flies on the ULA Atlas V, which is a very proven workhorse of a launch vehicle. In fact, a million years ago, astronauts flew on Atlases back Mercury Gemini timeframe. So this is sort of a return to flying astronauts on the Atlas platform, but the platform itself, that rocket, is very different from the ones that were used a long time ago. The launch for Boeing is on Launch Complex 41, which is over on the Air Force side. And they land actually the Boeing, on the very top is the Boeing capsule that comes back. Underneath it is its service module. And the capsule lands actually in the western United States in the desert. It's kind of, you'll see pictures in a moment. It uses landing airbags, comes down under parachutes. SpaceX flies the Crew Dragon. They have the Falcon 9 launch vehicle that's same as all their other launches. And they launch out of Launch Complex 39A, which was one of the shuttle launch pads. And they splash down in the Atlantic Ocean. They've got landing sites off the east coast of Florida, and then some on the Gulf side of Florida, but all seven sites all around Florida. Their capsule, the part that comes back, is on the very tip top, and then there's a service module just below it. It's got the depiction we've got, half of it is actually facing us, half of it's actually solar cells, and the other half is radiators, and so they kind of do some body pointing while they're in orbit for power generation. Boeing, actually, its solar panels are underneath the bottom, so they do pointing as well. The crews that we have assigned to this mission, we've got a number of them were assigned several years ago to really dig in with these providers and provide feedback as they were developing their capsules in terms of flyability, control panel orientation, you know, just all of the human factors things so that it makes sense to fly. And the two vehicles fly fairly differently. The Starliner is flies very much like the shuttle with the translational rotational hand controllers, two hand controllers. The SpaceX Dragon flies a bit more like flying your iPad with Candy Crush. It's touchscreen, but both of them are very workable in terms of how you're able to pilot the crafts. And you can see that you've got some of the crews on the Boeing side here on the left, Nicole Mann, Butch Wilmore, Mike Fink. The first Boeing rotation mission will have Josh Quesada, Sonny Williams, and Jeanette Epps. Of course, we flew SpaceX Demo 2 with Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley, and those guys were up for about 64 days and came back. They were May to August timeframe was when they were on station. And then we launched Crew 1 mission, and they've been up longer than any of the Skylab missions. That record was just broken over this last weekend. Victor Glover and Mike Hopkins are the pilot commander, and Shannon Walker and Soichi Noguchi are mission specialists. They're all on board space station as normal station crew doing science. And we took a really, really hands-on approach with commercial crew. And as I mentioned, the astronauts working side by side with Boeing and SpaceX, looking at all the best practices that we've learned on previous space vehicles, giving them feedback, everything with crew in the loop. And this depicts some of the pictures. You know, you've got crew training in capsules, crew training for, you know, getting off the pad, and, you know, in an emergency, you've got the MRAPs and decontamination station practice. We've got splashdown practices and recovery practices in the desert. You know, there's all kinds of rescue things that we work on, training with flyability, and working with the engineers from both the providers. It's been super valuable to have crew intimately involved. Of course, you know, the crew always wants to be involved in what's being developed so that it works when they get to fly it. And we actually did take that approach. And of course, both of the providers did the incremental build a little, test a little, and then fly, and iterated that all the way through. You know, they went through and completed and verified their systems design. They did flight hardware builds. They modified the launch facilities, which were, you know, on the Air Force side, it was set to build Air Force, to launch Air Force type rockets. And they had to actually build a white room out so you could get out and load crew and put in all the commodities there. SpaceX, same thing on the Cape side, had to build that out because that pad was originally set up for shuttle launches, a little bit different configuration. Lots of qual tests with really demanding in-flight environments. You guys have seen all the pictures of parachute tests and pad abort tests and engine tests. And they have been very successful for us to learn and fix things when they didn't work the way we intended to, and tweak designs to make it as safe as we can for the crew. Of course, where we are right now with Boeing did their pad abort test out at White Sands. That was really a successful test. And they did their uncrewed orbit flight test back in December of 2019. They didn't make it to space station. They made it to orbit. They had a software glitch that made the capsule think it was in the wrong place, and they ended up burning a lot more prop than anticipated. They fixed that problem and fixed a number of other things. They're on track right now for March 25th, so that's coming up soon, of this year, for a repeat of that OFT-2 mission with the hopes of docking the space station, and then a crewed flight test hopefully later this year. Crews are already training for that, as I mentioned, folks like Butch Wilmore and others. You can see here on the bottom, those are pictures of OFT that landed at White Sands. Lands on with airbags, so it's kind of an interesting recovery system. Comes down in parachutes, the airbags inflate, and it lands in the flat desert area. And then the picture on the lower right, there's actually like an inflatable tent that is placed over it to protect the capsule. White Sands has a lot of gypsum particulate matter. And so once it's down and the crew's out, they put the tent over it to protect the capsule before they wrap it up for transport back to KSC. They do all their servicing at Kennedy and turn it around and get ready to launch again. Really neat operation. Over on the SpaceX side, equally neat operation. We flew the Demo 1 uncrewed mission back in March of 2019. We had the in-flight abort test before that, in January of 2020. That was just about a year ago. We were reminiscing. That was the one where we launched a rocket and aborted with it, about 90 seconds after launch, and the rocket body blew up after the space capsule was far enough away, the aerodynamic forces. So that was a wild one to watch and be in the firing room for at Kennedy, but that worked really well, proving that their abort test, if you had to fire it from, while you're flying, it will work and get away from the capsule. We flew Demo 2, as I mentioned, mid-August of last year. And then we launched November 15th, which was Crew 1, and that crew's up there. That's the four on top waving by as they head to the pad. Bob and Doug pictured there as well as on their way, probably getting ready to go uphill in that picture. But on the bottom is the picture of their capsule. I think that was Endeavor. That splashed down. You can see when they come back through the atmosphere, they get a bit toasty like a marshmallow. So they swap out all those panels and things when they're going to fly the vehicle again. It's part of their servicing. But heat shields work super well. And splashdown, that one was in the Gulf, and they basically tow it in and put it up in that nest on the on their recovery ship, and the helicopter comes down and takes the crew to shore. It's a really neat operation. And we're hoping to have Crew 2 mission right now. It says spring 2021, it's May-ish. And then we have later in the year, 6 months after that, this fall will be Crew Mission 3, and crews are in training for those. To put all this together, we had a number of Space Act agreements. Between the commercial program, crew program, Blue Origin, Sierra Nevada, SpaceX and Boeing, and a lot of these, NASA helps provide expertise and insight into designs. So as a provider's building something, if they have, say, a question on propulsion, we can put them in touch with our propulsion engineers and work through designs. If it's atmospheric flight, like you're seeing here with the Sierra Nevada Dream Chaser, they work with our GNC and aero mechanics folks on design and updates and those sorts of things. So that's going to be a neat one because that's a wing vehicle. You can see it gliding back down. That was a parachute drop or a helicopter drop, down to a glided landing. That worked really well. And Blue Origin's got its New Glenn rocket under development. So some of the big benefits for commercial crew, of course, being that we are now with SpaceX, we're off to the regular and reliable transportation, and we're hoping to get there very soon with Boeing. The idea in the future, it's this parallel path. We actually would have two providers, and we'd alternate between SpaceX and Boeing and sending crews to space station when we get to that point. And then perhaps these folks can be used also to provide commercial capabilities, whether that be launches or lunar landings or whatever for Artemis missions, and then going beyond to Mars. So it's really trying to grow the partnership of using the commercial capabilities for that. Now for space station, of course, we have our ongoing mission, and to be able to regularly provide crews to space station enables for not just three astronauts from the US, but four to be up there. So a lot more science, it increases the whole crew to seven onboard space station, to do a whole lot more work. And of course, right now, we've got five USOS astronauts on space station because Kate Rubins went up on a Soyuz. So there's a lot more science going on space station, and the station program's really happy with that. So is the research community. By the way, I know a lot of you folks are out on social media, and there's a lot with regards to CCP for you to follow out there. Our websites, we're always on NASA TV. We have a lot of tweets going out on Twitter as we update things, and Facebook pages. You know, there's so much going on right now, and we're always putting out new announcements on Twitter, Facebook, or what have you, depending on when launch schedules move, when tests occur, when things are successful. And of course, you got a, you know, one that's on there right now, Shannon Walker, who's on board right now. She's one of the crew from Crew One, and she's doing a lot of science. And so the crews are very frequently reporting down their successes in terms of what's going on. You can see on the far right bottom, that's the whole crew on space station, the Crew One crew. And then on the back row are the two Russian cosmonauts and Kate. So that's the whole station crew there. All right. And that's the presentation. I think I'm open to take some questions if folks would like to at this point. I will stop sharing.
Hey, thanks, Mike. That was fantastic. That was fantastic. I think we've got a couple of questions. So the first question we've got is, have Boeing or SpaceX had any issues in getting a landing license from the FAA/AST, and does NASA assist in the process? And then there's a follow-on question to that.
Yeah, so FAA, this is a really interesting thing. So the demo missions are NASA licensed missions. And then once it becomes a crew mission, so Crew One is the first FAA licensed launch. And that license is from launch through landing. And so NASA helps facilitate that, but it's largely with the provider providing all the, whatever the requirements are for licensure to the FAA for licensing. Then what happens is, so then we, you know, we have to go through the normal process of picking a launch date with the range, the FAA is involved. So there's a lot of entities. We've got to get the DoD involved for rescue in the event we have like an abort off of Canada or something, the DoD would help go rescue the crew. So there's a lot of moving parts in just the launch licensing and all the preparation there. Then for landing, it's really the same thing. The provider works with the FAA in terms of getting the license for the specific day and setting up you know, flight restrictions and or maritime restrictions. If it's SpaceX, they're splashing down. If it's Boeing, they're going to the desert. So Boeing would just have flight restriction kind of things. You work with Coast Guard, they'd work with Coast Guard, FAA, make sure that everything's in order for that return. It all has to do with trajectory. And then of course, on the actual day, you got to watch the weather and you may have to wave off for that and not leave space station. So it's a pretty tricky process. But yeah, FAA is definitely involved in it, works with both of those providers on that.
Okay, fantastic. That question was from Tom Stagliano. The second part, and I think you've answered this, is what about the FAA landing license for the lifting body concept? And I think you kind of answered that.
Well, yeah, we haven't quite gotten to that phase yet because right now, I think Sierra Nevada's tests have largely been over test ranges and those sorts of things on military installations where we work with that entity. But when they get to the point of landing, we would work with the FAA on launch and landing licenses with that provider with us. Of course, their first launches would be test launches, so they'd be NASA licensed, but we'd still have to do all the airspace approvals and things with FAA. And dependent upon where they decide to come back, you'd work that as well with FAA and then with whoever controls that airspace, maybe it's Edwards or, you know, or some other location, you'd work with that. But we would be intimately involved. And when they get to actual crew rotations, the FAA would be all over it, working with them on a regular basis.
Fantastic. The next question we have is actually from Patrick Whalen or Pat Whalen. Does Boeing still need to do an in-flight abort test?
So this is interesting. Boeing is not planning to do an in-flight abort test. They did a pad test, but this is interesting. This goes back to the requirements. The providers were more or less able to come to NASA and say, here's how we want to demonstrate we meet this requirement. And Boeing went and said, we have all this analysis. We think we can show through analysis and models that our in-flight abort can be met that way. and NASA agreed. And SpaceX said, hey, we think we can show you in a test. And NASA agreed. So it was kind of up to how they showed they could meet that requirement. So Boeing does not have a plan to do an in-flight abort test, but they and NASA agreed to meet that requirement and verification through modeling and testing. Modeling and analysis.
Fantastic. Next question is from Dan Adamo. What considerations went into NASA's effort to obtain a seat on the next Soyuz launch to ISS?
Okay. So that's really the station program working with the Russians, and it's one of these things where, as SpaceX and Boeing are both kind of coming up to speed, we don't have Boeing as a provider, right? So right now, I mean, they're not ready to fly crews yet. So we don't really have two parallel paths. And you'd really like to have kind of two parallel paths going at any point so that if there's a problem with one, you've got a backup with the other. And so I think the station thought process is perhaps we can keep a path going on a Soyuz for a period of time until we have two U.S. parallel paths. But I mean, that's up to that program. That's sort of risk mitigation that the station program works out. And that's, you know, they've got to work that with, you know, policy, White House, State Department, all those kinds of things. But yeah, not our program. That's really how station wants to get its crews delivered. We are trying, you know, we've got SpaceX going, but it would be great if we could, you know, later this year have Boeing start flying crews, and then we can rely on two parallel path providers.
Okay, fantastic. Great. Next question is from Jeff Lee. Is the logistical support for Gateway an extension of CCP, or is it a completely a different contract?
Yeah, Gateway at this point is a completely different contract, but they have leaned on us for expertise in terms of how we were able to accomplish certain things through the commercial program so that they can make sure to implement lessons learned from us for that program. There's also been folks looking at, you know, Artemis and commercial landers for how we've done it in commercial crew, how we would do it if we had to do it again, maybe better. How would we improve it so that when we go forth and do perhaps any things in the future in a commercial endeavor, a private-public partnership, we don't fall into the same pitfalls and we learn from it and do better next time.
Great. Next question we've got is from Jai Ramakrishnan. Are there any changes due to the new administration on CCP milestones?
Not yet. So we don't even have a new administrator yet. So we've got no new policy from the Biden administration on anything yet with regards to CCP or anything we're working on. So we're plowing ahead on all the milestones we had in work previously.
Okay, great. So I've got a question for you, and this is sure. More about your role in as a manager for commercial crew. Can you talk about the responsibility that you've got as far as a go no go on the different launches?
Yeah, holy mackerel! So Steve Stitch, he was an asset entry flight director and worked shuttle program, and he'd been in commercial crew program for like 7-8 years before I was brought on board. And they realized they needed someone to handle this operations manager role. But I mean, they hired me and we were probably like 2 months from our first launch. And so I jumped in with both feet on training, and Stitch handled the first couple of launches. He did demo 1 and demo 2. And I actually was side saddle with him for in-flight abort test. So the in-flight abort test was my first test to be in the firing room and help give a go to launch, which is a talk about a weighty responsibility. Having been an EVA person before, planning spacewalks, training the crew and in charge of that for mission control, that's pretty stressful. But having a launch where so we have a lot, there's of course the provider's launch team, but we have a NASA launch team that is also verifying things and rolling up their go-no-goes to me. And I have several polling points that I check with our team. You know, we of course, I'm involved in making the weather call. So reviewing how's the weather for launch tomorrow? Are we going to be go? Or we need to scrub? Do we want to go ahead and tank? Because you start tanking and filling commodities early. And so you've got to commit to that. And I'm talking to all of our technical folks as we proceed through the count. We poll, get the crew in spacesuits and head them out to the pad? Or we go to enter the blast danger area and load the crew? Are we, you know, and then as failures and things happen in the count, we've got to disposition those. Are we still go? Is it a significant problem? Do we need to, you know, pull the crew out and fix a problem and try again another day? And then, of course, the last go, no go for either provider is go to launch. Now, SpaceX is a little bit different because they pressurize and fill some commodities before loading the crew, but the main propulsion elements are loaded in like the last 45 minutes before launch. So the crew's loaded, and then they start loading RP and liquid oxygen and then go. So that's an automated kind of system, which is a little bit different than how we used to do it on shuttle. And so I have the ability to have a no-go all the way up towards launch. But it gets really quiet because you're just watching the automated systems click through. Then, of course, we launch. We have a mission management team meeting. How'd the spacecraft work? Is everything functioning? Are we go and we have a meeting. Are we go to proceed to space station? And then the space station has a mission management team meeting. Are we ready for this craft to come dock with us? And so that gets us all the way to docking. And then we basically, it's the same sort of thing coming home. We're looking at weather, are the ships in the right position? Do we have all of our, you know, all of our logistics ready, you know, undock and then come on home, splash down and get the crew unloaded. Boeing's the same kind of thing. I'm in their launch control center giving the same sort of go, no goes. But they much more like shuttle did. There's more of their commodities are already fueled when they load the crew, and then they just do sort of final loading and pressurization. So, you know, it's interesting to see the different ways the launch counts go, but in essence, it's the same sort of thing. And wow, talk about a responsibility. You got, you know, 2 to 4 people you're friends with on that rocket with a lot of explosive and a million things that can go wrong, and you've got to very quickly get feedback from all this engineering community and the smart people, you know, is this a problem or not a problem? Are we go? And, you know, it's very fast paced and amazing. And it's a huge responsibility just to do that during the launch count. And of course, I have all kinds of simulations and lots of flight rules and things I'm working with the flight operations director on and with the providers to make sure everything's safe for the mission and all the planning. But wow, it's, if I had hair, it would be gray by now.
Great. I think we've got probably time for one more question. And the actually, the last question is from Sudhir Pai. I hope I pronounced his last name correctly. But as space debris continues to be an issue, what technology exists to mitigate it? And more important, what technology exists for collision avoidance?
Oh, okay. So we still work with the appropriate range coordinators and the Department of Defense that sort of look and see are just the same way they do with space station. Space station, they do periodically have to do a debris avoidance maneuver if they come up with a probability of conjunction at a certain level, and they'll move space station. We do the same sort of thing when we're launching and when we're flying to station. There's a clearing, making sure our trajectory isn't going to, you know, cross paths with any piece of space debris that they've got cataloged, and make sure we're okay. Then when we're on space station, we're with space station. As they move, we move. And then we do the same sort of look clearing to come home. You know, hopefully the entities that do that will get better. I mean, I know there's discussion of, using space tugs and the like to clear larger pieces of debris and bring them back. I mean, this is all hypothetical. Commercial crew isn't involved in it, but some sort of methodology to clear out space debris, whether you attach to a rocket body and deorbit it so that it safely comes in and doesn't inadvertently collide with another satellite or rocket body that's out there and create more smaller debris. That's not what you want. Anything that can help us clear out low Earth orbit. If you've seen, it looks like a beehive with all these bees for all the things that are out there, and it's a scary environment. You want to lessen that. And so anything we can do to both not jettison, have things not be jettisoned as much and minimize that, we try to. Of course, there's all these, there's lots of launches going on all the time, and there's more and more items that are added to the catalog. And so it just continues to get worse. But hopefully we will come up with a better methodology to minimize that and how to clean it up. I mean, I know when I worked in Building 9, there were tests going on for, ways to sort of harpoon up the engine bell and perhaps move rocket bodies back. And there were, I know these things have been tested in the past. Hopefully they get put in, in practice soon. Hope that helps, Jorge.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No. Thanks so much. Again, want to thank you. I mean, fantastic. I knew you were going to give a fantastic presentation, and it definitely was. So definitely want to thank you for coming out to AIAA and speaking for in front of our section. I know that a lot of the folks want to get back, and we obviously want to have these things live. It would have been great to see you live, because I've seen you speak live, and you're even more dynamic. So, I mean, but definitely want to thank you. I just probably want to just do some just closing remarks for our section. Like I was mentioning before, we do have, for all of you that are out viewing this, we do have, like I mentioned, we do have a lot of events coming up. We're always looking for volunteers, especially for the three main events that we've got: the AIAA, the Astros baseball outing that we're looking for in May, the joint ASME, IEEE, AAA joint meeting in July. So for the Houston Astros baseball outing, if you are interested in volunteering for that, and interested in supporting that, if you can get with Rosie Hernandez. If you're interested in the joint ASME, IEEE, AIAA meeting, if you can get with Svetlana Hansen. And then obviously our technical symposium, which is in October. Like I said, papers are, the abstracts are due in July. If you can get with Wanda Segur, John DiOrio, or Mayur Ahuja, that would be great. And then with that, the only thing I would want to say is, remember, March 15th is the AIAA Congressional Visit Day. On this Saturday at 8:30, we've got another Space Geek Speak. And the next one of these is going to be on April 8th. Again, it's going to be the folks from Engineers Without Borders. It'll be our local branch of Engineers Without Borders. And they're going to be talking about the work they're doing on the Kenya project. So with that, I want to thank everybody for attending. I'll give you guys about 6 minutes back of your day. And thanks so much. Appreciate it, everybody.